This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 194 was recorded on November 21st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by Freelancer.com, the best place on the internet to hire freelancers for any job description. My feature interview guest this week is Peter Bookvar, editor of The Book Report and chief investment officer for Bleakley Advisory Group. We'll discuss monetary policy, the macro backdrop, and how to translate those views into portfolio positioning strategies. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick and I will take a tour of the commodities complex with another of Patrick's famous post-game chart decks. And finally, a quick housekeeping note. Due to the American Thanksgiving holiday next week, Macro Voices will air one day early on Wednesday, November 27th, when CPM Group's Jeffrey Christian will join me as our feature interview guest.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 has been toying with trying to start a market correction, but every time it seems like the selling's about to start, the bulls bring it right back and just it seems like it's more choppy than anything else. What's your take on the S&P here?
Well, Charlie McElligott told us he expected a short-term tactical pullback, so maybe one has begun in the last few days. As far as the choppiness that we're seeing, I think it's all based on this frankly irrational preoccupation that the market seems to have with this China trade deal signal. It's on again, it's off again, and for anyone who hasn't caught the news this week, basically China trade deal is back on, but at the same time, the House and Senate have passed a bill which would endorse or support the Hong Kong protesters, angering China, potentially jeopardizing the bill. So we've got conflicting signals, and that's causing all of this choppiness in the market. It seems to me this should have been clear for months and months and months now. Of course, there's going to be some kind of China trade deal. It's in both leaders' interests for there to be one, and it therefore behooves everyone to have one. At the same time, we're going into a negotiation where everybody goes in with high hopes, and usually people come out feeling at least somewhat disappointed that they didn't get everything that they asked for. So it's a setup for the market to go higher until the final deal comes in and it's not quite what everybody expected, and maybe that's where we move lower. Meanwhile, we have to start to look toward election outcome uncertainty taking more and more of the spotlight. Markets don't like uncertainty, and we certainly have a very contentious election coming up. So I think those are going to be some of the factors that drive it. But as far as I can see, monetary policy is going to keep taking us higher, save perhaps for a pullback, which maybe has begun.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, which we're pretty much pinned right to the 98 level, and it doesn't seem like we've got any breakout in sight. What's your intuition as to where we're going next here on the dollar?
Well, we had a good strong bounce off of 97, and it looked promising, got us up to 98 and a quarter or so. But for the last few days, it's been kind of floundering. A daily close below 97 would establish a pattern of lower lows and lower highs. That would be very bearish. A daily close above 98.50 would be a signal that this recovery is alive and healthy. Until then, we're kind of in no man's land here. So let's wait and see.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because what a whipsaw that was. I mean, we had a big break and it reversed, and now we're breaking to a multi-month high here on crude oil, almost at 59. What's your take on how the crude oil markets are playing out here?
Well, as you said, Patrick, talk about a whipsaw market for the last few weeks, really, particularly for the last few days. Now, we've got some very strong technical analysis signals at today's close telling us we've got a decisive directional trend in play, that we're seeing a move higher in crude oil. But wait a minute, 48 hours ago, we had equally decisive technical analysis signals telling us the exact opposite. And 24 hours before that, we had opposite signals still again. So there's been lots and lots of whipsawing action back and forth here. At the moment, the tape looks pretty bullish. I would have said the opposite 48 hours ago. In general, though, what's happening is open interest and commitment of traders data support the speculation that I shared with our listeners a few weeks back, which is I think what's going on here is longer time frame investors are coming into the long side of WTI crude oil futures. So we're seeing that while the inventory reports and so forth affect the market on a day-to-day basis, the trend is that there's been this persistent bid. Now, I think a lot of that was driven by the Saudi Aramco IPO. Frankly, I think that's irrational because the IPO is not very well organized and won't really be offered in Western markets. The OI was back down, the open interest back down this week as maybe some of those bulls were giving up early, but I would imagine after what we've seen in the last couple of days that that open interest is going to come right back up again. Then we had this week's inventory reports. Crude oil building 1.4 million barrels. Now, that was approximately in line with expectations, but API, the private data service, had set expectations the night before for a much, much larger build. So when it came in as a smaller build, it was interpreted bullishly by the market. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 2.3 million barrels this week. Now, it's very curious to me because during this reporting period, the Keystone Pipeline was only off for 2 days, and we've got a really big drawdown. The previous period, the Keystone Pipeline was offline for all 7 days, and we had half as big of a drawdown. So it's a little curious as to what happened there. I almost wonder if there's a data anomaly or reporting error in the data. It's going to be very interesting to see now that the Keystone Pipeline is back online, but at reduced pressure and therefore reduced daily throughput, what that's going to do to the trend of Cushing builds that was in play previously. So we'll be watching that carefully. Gasoline building 1.8 million barrels, distillates drawing down 974,000 barrels. U.S. production holding 12.8 million barrels, that's unchanged, and it was a new record when it was set just last week. Imports 6 million barrels, exports 3 million barrels. Tape action after that report was just rocketing to the upside. Now, almost everyone seems to be associating that big upward performance with the inventory report. I really don't think that's what was driving all of it. The inventory is certainly part of it. But that face-ripping rally was probably more about the fact that Yemeni Houthi rebels reportedly shot down an F-15, Saudi Arabian F-15, and the Alberta rail strike is going to have a very significant impact on oil by rail delivery logistics. So I think those factors probably had as much to do with this rally of the last 2 days as inventory data did. One way or another, whatever's driving it, the direction for the last 48 hours has been straight up. Thursday morning, as soon as we hit the opening bell, the market moved up and it just kept going all day and right through the close. The Hong Kong bill, which put a big damper in the stock market rally, didn't seem to interfere with crude oil. So it seems like this is not just optimism about the China trade deal, as a lot of people have said. I think what's going on here is longer-term buyers are coming into this market, and I won't be surprised if it drives the market considerably higher. And finally, Patrick, I'll just close with the one caveat that, it seems pretty darn clear that the direction is up now, that we've got a resolution to the very narrow trading range, the consolidation that has persisted in this market since the 3rd of November. It seems like that resolution is to the upside. But as I said, it seemed 24 or 48 hours ago like it was to the downside. Maybe it's going to reverse again. We'll see what happens.
All right, let's move on to gold. We've seen that over the last week that gold's been consolidating, but it can't seem to muster up any strength back toward 1500 and looks almost heavy, like it's rolling over. Do you think there's more selling to come in gold?
Well, we closed below that 1465 number. That was the September low today, and I do think there's more selling coming. Right now, we're right in the middle of the price channel. Now, the bottom of that price channel has moved down to about $1,420. That happens to be the downside target that I've been talking about for the last couple of weeks in terms of where some Fibonacci levels are. So I won't be surprised if in coming weeks we drift back down and eventually get to 1420. I'll be buying the dips along the way, but I won't start really buying in earnest until we get to 1420. And if we get below 1400, it's really time to start buying.
All right, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, which after approaching near 2%, we've backed up back under 180, and we're trading right now around 1.77. What's your thinking here on yields?
Well, the only reason that I can think of to be bearish bonds is if you think inflation is coming back. Well, guess what? We've talked to some really smart people in the last couple of weeks who think that inflation is coming back, and inflation famously is the arch enemy of the bond market. So I don't think it's upon us right now, but I think that as far as any long-term bullish outlook for bonds, at some point, inflation is going to come into the game, and you've got to think about how that plays into the equation. Do you want to go the other way and think about a long-term bearish argument for bonds? Well, for reasons that Ray Dalio has articulated so well in his writings recently, I don't think that the government has to let the bond market sell off, and I don't think they're going to because it causes too many other problems for the government. So it leaves me without a lot of firm commitment or conviction in either direction, and I'm happy to be on the sidelines.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's feature interview guest is Peter Buchvar. Why did we invite Peter back to the show this week?
Well, we met Peter almost by accident. Danielle DiMartino Booth recommended Peter, a friend of hers, as a co-star, if you will, when we did our summer special. And we got a lot of positive feedback on that special. We realized Peter's the kind of guy who deserves his own solo appearance on Macro Voices. And he ended up doing a special two-week show with Danielle before he ever got his own interview. So we wanted to get him back. It's taken until now to get him back. And I think that our listeners are going to find a number of his views to be very enlightening. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Freelancer.com. Now, many of you already listened to my interview with Pippa Malmgren, in which she predicted that baby boomers will go back to work en masse, but not in the same way they did before in full-time jobs. Pippa predicts that they'll go back to work as freelancers. In case you missed it, I strongly encourage you to listen to that interview, which is linked in your Research Roundup email. And the place they will go back to work will most likely be Freelancer.com, the largest freelance marketplace in the world by number of users and projects posted, with 39 million users and over 16 million projects posted. In terms of opportunity, it's definitely a glass half full when you consider how you can turn your dreams into reality using Freelancer.com, the eBay of jobs on a global scale. They operate in 247 countries, regions, and territories in 34 languages and 45 currencies. From jobs as diverse as web design, graphic design, copywriting, through astrophysics, aerospace engineering, financial research, or manufacturing. And getting in on this as an investor couldn't be easier. Freelancer.com is listed on the Australian Stock Exchange under ticker symbol FLN.
Eric's interview with Peter Buchvar is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer for Bleakley Advisory Group and the editor of The Book Report, a very popular market newsletter. Peter, thanks so much for joining us this week. I want to start with the big picture macro. You know, we've had so many conflicting signals and so many different viewpoints. How would you summarize this big picture? It seems like on one hand, there's a lot of good reasons, if you look at bond yields and so forth, to think that we're seeing recession signals. Boy, the stock market didn't get the memo, if that's the case. How do you make sense of all these conflicting signals?
Well, I think that the growth story still points to moderation. Obviously, manufacturing related to the trade tensions has impacted global trade, and which is now impacting capital spending and is now beginning to spill over into services. And this seems to be a global thing. When you look at starting in Asia, where this really started again on the manufacturing and trade side, and the consumer in a lot of these countries still hung in. Unemployment rates were low, debt levels were high, but savings rates were high as well. You look at Europe, you look at Germany, for example, I'd use that as an example, is 40% of their economy is exports, and that's certainly been negatively impacted by the trade tensions and the slowdown in Asia, with China being their biggest trade partner. but their unemployment rate at the lowest since reunification still pointed to a consumer that had their job, actually saw improving wage gains, and consumer spending actually hung in. But we're beginning to see signs that that weakness is beginning to spill over into services. And we're certainly seeing it in the U.S., where 3 months in a row of a below 50 ISM manufacturing number has negatively impacted the services side, which makes sense. I mean, the manufacturer makes something, and then it's a transportation company, which is a services company, that then has to transport it somewhere else. And then all the businesses that cater to the transportation side and so on and so forth. So then you shift to, okay, when will the U.S. consumer get impacted by this slowdown? And that will be determined by the state of the labor market. Well, recently we're seeing a slowdown in the pace of hirings. The question is, okay, when do we see an increase in the pace of firings? And last week, we did see initial jobless claims rise to the highest level since June. Now, I don't want to overreact to one number. It could be related to timing with Veterans Day and that being a bank holiday, and we'll have to see how that number is in the coming weeks. But maybe that's a sign that at least on the firing side that there is a sort of change. With respect to the consumer, we did see retail sales come out for October that was softer than expected. And pointing to, while the consumer is still spending, it's not really at a robust pace. Home Depot reported numbers that missed. I did listen to the conference call. They did try to differentiate between the state of consumer spending and what they blamed some of their capital spending initiatives not taking hold yet as being the reason for their miss. But on a ticket basis, on a traffic basis, you know, trends are only about 2% for Home Depot. Then you had Kohl's. Now, Kohl's obviously is impacted by their department store exposure, but that stock is down sharply because of a miss in comps. So I think the consumer is okay, but there's some holes in that story, and that is what concerns me if it were to continue.
Let's talk about interest rates and treasury yields. I remember when we had you on for our special with Danielle DiMartino Booth, you were not of the opinion that the U.S. would get to negative interest rates. Is that still your view? And I suppose another related question is, has this backup in yield that we've seen from 1.50 or so in the 10-year back to about 1.80 as we're talking today, has the trend reversed, or are we just looking at a little correction here?
Okay, a few things. To answer that, I do not think we go negative. I think the most important thing we're seeing right now, which led to the main reason which led to a rise in longer term US rates, was a change in the mentality towards the extreme monetary policy of the Bank of Japan and ECB. So let's start with Japan. You have, after 20 plus years of extraordinary easing, you have Kuroda now saying he wants higher long-term interest rates because they see what's happened to the banking system. Now, throughout this incredible, extraordinary monetary experiment that we've seen over the past 10 years, the thought was, okay, how does this end? When does this end? And I think the natural response was, well, it'd be a bout of inflation that would sort of take away the printing press from these central banks. And it occurred to me from seeing comments from a bunch of central bankers over the last couple months is that it's not going to be inflation that does it. It's going to be the realization of the damage they've done to their banking sector. And the Japanese TOPIX Bank Index is down 90% from where it was in 1989. So I think you're reaching a point where the regional bank stocks in Japan are literally going out of business, and that the Bank of Japan realizes they need a steeper yield curve. There's a story on the day of our interview here from Bloomberg saying an unprecedented level of concern about damaging side effects of Japan's multi-decade experiment with ultra-low interest rates has gripped policymakers, regulators, and legislators. So here we are in what I believe is the end game of this monetary massive activism. And then you shift to the ECB. So on September 12th, Draghi pushed it again when further negative interest rates tiered it to somewhat mitigate the impact, and then reinitiated a monthly QE of 20 billion euros a month. Well, we had an internal revolt within the European Central Bank in response to that. with not just behind the scenes criticism, but vocal criticism on the outside, literally the next day after that meeting. So that tells me that Christine Lagarde is at her end game in what she can do on the monetary side. And that's why she'll be much more vocal on and trying to encourage more fiscal stimulus with a lot of the Eurozone countries. So since those two, I think, changes of mentality and behavior in Japan and Europe, I think that was the sort of the tinder for the rise in longer term interest rates in Japan and Europe and in the US. So you add on the possibility of a Brexit deal, obviously the hopes of a China-US trade deal, which is what the stock market, of course, is riding on a daily basis. And this belief that three rate cuts from the Fed can generate faster growth that would lead to higher long-term rates. So I think this all came together. But I will argue, though, that those August low in yields, because, again, the change in mentality within the BOJ and the ECB, are yields that we're not going to see for a long time. Now, that said, there will be this tug of war between a day when treasuries and yields respond to the data, and then days when you get comments from the Bank of Japan that says we want higher long-term interest rates, and that then leads to higher long yields. So there's going to be a tug of war, but I think those August lows could be the lows for a very long time in yield.
Now, Peter, I just want to clarify, you said that you don't think that a resurgence of inflation will be the factor that changes central bankers' minds. Does that mean that you don't think that inflation is coming, or that just that you don't think it will have the effect that people think it's going to have?
Well, no. I think the initial effect of the change in central bank behavior is what they've done to the banks. On the inflation side, that still could come. That still could be a factor in popping this bond bubble of ours. And, you know, on the inflation side, people like to say, look at inflation as black or white. It's either up, it's down. But inflation is services and goods. And you look in the U.S., for example, services inflation has remained at a 2.5, actually, I would say closer to 3% year-over-year rate of gain for years now. The only thing that's keeping inflation in check has been this goods deflation. So the question is how long can goods prices stay depressed to offset that services inflation? And, you know, I'm not necessarily sure of the answer. I originally thought that the tariff situation we're in right now would reverse that and we'd start to see some more goods inflation. But at least right now, that's sort of getting lost in whether it's the Chinese that are eating it, the U.S. manufacturers that are eating it, and not enough filtering through the consumer. I still think more will filter through to the consumer, and that you will get some goods inflation that matches up with services inflation. But the timeline, I'm not sure yet. But just statistically, we have the Atlanta Sticky Fed CPI, which takes out all the volatile components, which is running north of 2.5%. We have core CPI, which is running 2.3%, which is a tenth off the highest level in 11 years. We have a Cleveland trimmed CPI, which is running at an 11-year high. It's only the PCE, which the Fed has isolated as their inflation gauge, that is giving them the belief that inflation is low relative to their 2% target. But digging even deeper to differentiate the PCE from CPI, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, is that PCE, the biggest component of it is healthcare. And the way that it measures healthcare is Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement rates, which if you talk to any doctor, you know that those are artificially suppressed to uneconomic levels. In a sense, the government is price fixing the cost of healthcare at a very low rate. That's being captured in PCE. That is what is suppressing PCE. Unfortunately, that is the inflation gauge the Fed is thus relying on in making monetary policy. If you look at CPI, CPI is actually measuring out-of-pocket healthcare expenses. Well, in the October CPI print, medical care rose 4% year over year. And that's why you see such a large spread between CPI and PCE. Then you add on CPI as a larger housing component than PCE. So I guess my point of all this is that inflation is not dead for those that say it is. Inflation is still there, particularly on the services side. And all you need is just a cyclical upturn in goods inflation. And we have a completely different inflation story globally.
Okay, so to summarize, you think we may be about to see a resurgence of inflation, but your real critical point is even if we don't, there are other good reasons to think that the bond bubble may be ending as a result of central bankers realizing the errors of their ways, if you will.
Yes, right now it's more of the latter. I mean, you look at the Swedish Riksbank, which had minus 50 basis points for years in their benchmark rate. They raised rates this year to minus 25. And in their last meeting, they basically said, we want out of negative interest rates. We are going to raise rates in December. So let's put aside the weaker data. We need to get rid of negative interest rates. Now, it's a small country. It's a somewhat irrelevant central bank when you compare it to the others, but it's another repudiation of negative interest rates. And I think that in itself creates a bottom in how far yields can drop. And that's why I think the $17 trillion of negative yielding securities that we saw in August, that's a level we're not going to see again. And that we've seen a reduction in that number. A lot of it, again, because we're seeing finally and hopefully a continued repudiation of negative interest rates because of the damage it's done to the banking system, particularly in Europe, where about 80% of the loans given in Europe are from the banking sector. Well, the European Bank Stock Index is down 80% from where it was in 07. How do you have a healthy economy? How do you have a functioning transmission mechanism for monetary policy if you kill the profitability? And the ECB says, oh, well, volumes are up, loan volumes are up, so therefore it's working. Well, it reminds me of like Pets.com in 1999 selling a lot of stuff, and volumes went up every month, but they were losing money on every sale. Well, that's the same thing with European banks. They may increase their loan volume, but if their margins are shrinking, well, that's not necessarily profitable loan growth.
Peter, you mentioned Europe. We've got Christine Lagarde taking the helm of the ECB, and of course, we still have the Brexit situation on the horizon. How do you see that playing into your overall macro view?
I think Boris Johnson wins handily. I think that's more stating the obvious. I think if you just look at the polls, and I think that is going to be resolved very soon after. And I think that whole drama after 3.5 years resolves itself. And that will certainly be a positive for the UK economy and those trading partners, particularly in Europe. Now, what happens after in terms of what new trade deals we get? You know, there's still going to be probably a period of uncertainty, but I'm actually pretty bullish, and I have been on the pound and pound denominated UK stocks that have suffered over the last bunch of years. I think with Lagarde, and I think you know that Brexit resolution could lead to further upward pressure in gilt yields, just for the sole purpose that uncertainty has been resolved. Lagarde's just in a really impossible situation because, as I mentioned, her hands are completely tied in terms of her ability to maneuver monetary policy to an extent that would actually stimulate growth. I mean, the negative interest rates, I believe, is not easing. It's actually restrictive policy because you are damaging your banks. So she is going to do her best to try to encourage governments to employ fiscal stimulus. But then you get into the question of, okay, fiscal stimulus. Is it just Japanese-style Keynesian spending? We're just going to pave some roads and redo some bridges and hope that leads to, you know, some sort of virtuous cycle of economic growth? No, it never does. So the question then is, well, what other types of fiscal stimulus? Well, maybe cutting the corporate income tax rate, some tax-related stimulus. Yeah, that can work. But you look at Germany, for example. As I said earlier, the unemployment rate is at the lowest level since reunification in the early 1990s. Are tax cuts going to help? Yeah, maybe. Maybe that'll make them spend more. But you know, that's not the issue. And fiscal stimulus, I don't know if it is going to be the panacea that so many people think it will. You look at Japan. Japan's been doing Keynesian-style fiscal spending for 25-plus years, and they have nice bridges and nice roads, but that doesn't mean that it's led to, you know, handoff to the private side of the economy. So it's all a very difficult situation. And, you know, sometimes if I was in places of power in these countries, sometimes doing nothing is actually doing something because it lets a cycle work its way through. And particularly with all this debt out there, if somehow you can encourage less of debt accumulation, that would be helpful to growth in and of itself.
Peter, let's talk about the U.S.-China trade negotiations. So many people seem to think this is really what it's all about, that it's when we get a resolution and some kind of trade deal that everybody's going to jump for joy and markets can only go up at that point. Is that the right way to think about this? And what's your view in general about the U.S.-China trade relationship?
Well, at least the stock market, and not so the bond market. The bond market seems to be focusing actually on the economic data. The stock market's betting on the hopes of a deal. And they're looking at this in very binary. There's either a deal of some sort or there's no deal. There's either some tariffs taken off or not. But let's just say there is a cosmetic deal of some sort. If the December tariffs don't go into place and the September 1st tariffs come off, well, yeah, that's a good thing. But Trump has put himself into such a tariff corner that there will still be tariffs on the existing $250 billion worth of industrial goods that will stay in place. Now, maybe they'll lay out thresholds that the Chinese have to meet next year in order to roll back those tariffs. I don't know. The wording of that will have to be very nuanced because the Chinese are not going to want to be humiliated and thrown over a barrel about how to get out of these tariffs. But I think that the damage being done by the tariffs don't just go away if some of them don't get implemented. So I think that sticks around for a longer period of time than the markets are making it seem. The market's expecting this economic inflection point where manufacturing, global trade, capital spending all move higher the day you get this trade deal. And I think it's going to be much more complicated than that because it's clear that there's still going to be a big chunk of these tariffs that are going to remain in place. And also the sword is going to hang over that. Let's just say the Chinese don't adhere to the things we want next year in terms of IP protection or whatever. Well, you know, those tariffs can come right back on again. So there's still going to be that level of cloudiness in terms of visibility with respect to business and these tariffs. Now, I'll take a trade deal of some sort. I'll take a detente and a truce and some of these tariffs going away. I just think that the stock market is being overly aggressive in thinking there's going to be this big, steep curve upward in economic activity once it gets put in place.
Well, Peter, I could not agree with you more on that point. I think the market is really pricing in more than is really there in terms of the importance of this trade deal. But let's come back to U.S. monetary policy now. The Fed has given us three cuts that they've described as insurance cuts, if you will. There were mid-cycle adjustments that we should not interpret as the beginning of a new rate-cutting cycle, according to FOMC speak, if you will. Where is this headed? Can the Fed engineer a soft landing that will undo the recession so many people have predicted? And, you know, where do we go from here after these insurance cuts? They've kind of backed themselves in a corner, I think, where the messaging they've given makes it pretty hard for them to make a fourth cut without admitting that it's a change in policy direction. What happens next?
So the track record of the Fed in terms of engineering soft landings, if you look since World War II, we've had 13 rate hiking cycles, and then 10 put us into a recession. And the three that did not were more earlier on in an economic recovery that it was easier to pull off. Here we are, obviously, in the 11th year, and still dealing with legacy hikes and legacy balance sheet decreases, obviously now trying to be offset by the three rate cuts. And we can get into a discussion about whether this is QE or not QE with all the T-bill purchases that are now in place at a pace of $60 billion a month. Now, the Fed and Jay Powell are under an extraordinary amount of pressure from the president, who wants them to be obviously very aggressive with their rate cuts. But the Fed, they want to be able to pull off this soft landing. They don't want to send a lot of the whole mid-cycle adjustment and the insurance cuts. There's also a messaging thing. Now, we keep hearing how the U.S. economy is in a good place, a good place, a good place. But here we are with a Fed funds rate of only 1.5% to 1.75%. How good of a place does the Fed think it's in if they think that we can't handle a Fed funds rate north of 1.5% to 1.75%? I mean, the Fed in their rate hiking cycle, they wanted to get to 3%. And they were dead stopped in their tracks at 2.25%, 2.5% was where they got stuck. And that is because of the macro environment changed on them. And you had the tariffs, and all of a sudden, they realized that there was no way they were going to get to 3% without doing serious damage to the U.S. economy and the global economy. Now, I think we're at a point where I'll give them their three insurance cuts, okay? Not that I thought that or think that this is going to work. I don't think lowering interest rates from an already low level is very stimulative. I mean, when you think about what monetary policy or even fiscal is supposed to do, it's supposed to stimulate behavior to happen today rather than waiting till tomorrow. Well, when you already have low interest rates, a cut further to a lower rate of interest doesn't stimulate anything because the original level of interest rates wasn't a binding constraint on your decision making. Now, yes, the housing market has improved, but I more attribute that to the drop in longer term interest rates because worry is about growth. And as a follow on from early part of this year when the Fed backed off and the ECB initiated more QE and this and that. So it's the longer end that's helped the housing market rather than the Fed's cut in short rates. I don't think that the cut in short rates is going to really help auto buying. I mean, that's another interest rate sensitive thing. The current rate of average rate of a credit card interest rate is 17%. That's a record high in data going back to 1994. But a lot of that is not related to interest rates on the short end. It's related to a lot of regulatory issues. So we're not going to necessarily get a help to consumers and their credit card interest rates. So pushing on a string, which any student of history knows, the saying that pushing on a string is the result of cutting rates and it doesn't stimulate anything. And I think that's the point where we're at. Now, the Fed will rely on going further deeper with respect to interest rates. But if they cut again, this is no longer an insurance cut. It is no longer mid-cycle adjustment. If they cut again from here, whether it's in December or it's sometime in 2020, that would be to address a deeper economic slowdown. So if you are a growth bull, you better hope that they're done cutting interest rates. If you're on the bear side, you're saying, you know what, this is just going to end up being a replay of the last two rate cutting cycles where they tried to offset the initial weakness. That weakness then continued. They got caught into continued rate cuts and the cycle basically took them over. Right now, the market sees the Fed as being in control. They believe in that soft landing scenario. Then they are like Pavlov's dog, believing that we're in the midst of another round of QE. Therefore, how can stocks go down if the Fed's doing QE? You know, I do think eventually the fundamentals will take over for better or for worse, and that good news will be good news and bad news will be bad news. But at least right now, it's this China trade deal will save all problems. The Fed will engineer a soft landing. And you know what? We got some QE. Therefore, just keep driving stocks higher. I would tell people to focus on jobless claims every Thursday and look at the 10-year yield. If the 10-year yield can't get above 2%, then at least the treasury market has a lot less confidence in that soft landing scenario and the economic benefits of a light deal between U.S. and China.
Peter, let's translate these macro views to how we position portfolios. Starting with the stock market, do you like the stock market at this juncture? As I think you said already, it already seems to very aggressively have priced in a lot of things that you and I both aren't really sure it should be believing in. What do you do in this environment? Are there still appealing sectors?
So I look at the broader market just for perspective on valuations, but you know, trying to pick a direction in the stock market has obviously proven to be a fool's game over many years and many decades. So I do my best to try to find interesting stock-specific stories within the context of my macro views and be less sensitive to trying to figure out where the S&P is going to go. But as a value investor, you still have to pay attention to where's the S&P priced. And as of this week, being the week of the 18th of November, the price to sales ratio, and I like to look at that within the S&P because it sort of it takes out the a lot of the shenanigans that companies go through with respect to earnings, whether that's due to tax rates or the level of interest rates and how they can refinance debt and lowering their interest expense, or it's non-recurring stuff that they take out or whatever. Price to sales is at least the sales parts you can't really manipulate. So the price to sales ratio in the S&P 500 is basically exactly where it was in early 2000. Now, this is not a timing tool. Valuations don't matter until they do, but I think it's a good valuation gut check, I like to call it, on where we are in this cycle. That here we are, at least from that valuation metric, back to where you were in early 2000. And I think what we're seeing in the IPO market, with the WeWorks, the Ubers, the Lyfts, that there is a valuation rethink going on here. And that valuation all of a sudden does matter. And that maybe there is a difference between a software stock that's trading at 30 times sales, not earnings, but 30 times sales. Maybe that's a little too much. Maybe companies that don't make any money shouldn't be valued at the same level. So I think this valuation rethink is certainly happening in the private space, because you can imagine the entire VC community is getting marked down in terms of valuations. But now it's now beginning to show up in the public markets, and even stable big cap companies, whether it's McDonald's, that before they reported their last quarter earnings was trading at 25, 26 times earnings, and that got marked down. Or Home Depot, which I mentioned earlier, was trading at 23, 24 times, no room for error there. All of a sudden, these valuations begin to matter. So to your original question of how do you find situations, how do you find opportunities? And as a value guy who has suffered the last couple of years in terms of the underperformance relative to the growthy things, I think value all of a sudden looks more attractive, because embedded in a value stock is low expectations. Well, if there's low expectations, the asymmetry comes in beating those expectations. Whereas a growth stock, the asymmetry is, well, if you miss, you're going to be in deep trouble in terms of your stock price, because the growth is expectations are already high and they're already embedded in that valuation. Therefore, if you keep beating, there's only so much upside from there. So the value side is where I think you need to look. And it's not just in the U.S. There are plenty of value opportunities outside of the U.S. I mean, the international performance relative to U.S. stocks over the past 10 years has been rather dramatic. Now, part of that is for a reason. Returns on equity are lower in companies doing business that are domiciled overseas. U.S. returns on equity tend to be higher. Therefore, we're going to be always have usually a higher multiple than overseas. But there's still a lot of attractive opportunities in emerging Asia. I think even in Europe, where you actually get dividend yields that are attractive, low multiples. Now, if everything falls, if the global economy goes into recession and markets respond, no one's going to be immune. But I just think when you look out over the next 5 to 10 years, you really need to broaden your time horizon. You need to widen your geographic scope. And I do think value starts to outperform growth.
Now, you said you were not convinced that there would necessarily be a resurgence of inflation. Are commodities attractive at this valuation level, in your opinion?
So my favorite is gold and silver, even though I sort of look at them as currencies rather than commodities. To me, that's my favorite asset in this topsy-turvy world right now. And that's notwithstanding my belief that we're going to see a shrinking pile of negative yielding interest rates, because I still think that inflation is going to be rather sticky. I mean, you look at this jump in 10-year yields of about 40 basis points off its lows. Well, the embedded inflation rate in the TIPS market rose by a similar amount. So real rates actually haven't risen much at all. Only the rise in nominal yields has taken place. But gold has corrected, because people sometimes look at the nominal rate. So I think that the Fed will continue to cut rates, because I think we will cross the Rubicon of what's insurance and what's addressing a deeper softness. And that will be negative for the dollar. And to me, the dollar's already topped out. I think we're seeing that against a variety of currencies. Outside of gold and silver, my favorite long-term commodity is copper. And I happen to own copper stock as a play on that. Now, copper, of course, is an industrial metal. It's going to be subject to China's economy and where the global economy goes. But I think there's also a secular shift in the demand for copper in electric vehicles and in the whole renewable solar wind thing that's going to consume a lot of copper. I mean, an electric vehicle consumes multiples of copper that a car that's just run on an internal combustion engine does. So the reliance on construction and autos, I think, is going to start to shift. And there's also a big supply issue with copper. There are deficits now, and I expect the deficits to remain in the coming year. So yes, maybe we get a moderation on the demand side if the global economy continues to slow. But I think it's very possible that the supply side is so crimped that copper prices will hold in. And when you do get a pickup in global growth in the next couple of years, I think copper is going to be a main beneficiary. When I look at oil prices, I do pay attention a lot to what's going on in U.S. shale. And we're seeing this essentially a collapse in investment that's driven by investors that want profits and an oil price that, while it's still pretty healthy, you know, mid-50s, I don't think is enough to drive cash flow for a lot of these, you know, middle and third tier shale companies. So relying on U.S. shale to be that big production source, I don't think is happening. So the supply side I see in global oil is actually, I don't think, is going to meet expectations. Now, if the demand falters, then oil prices could stay around these levels. But if demand hangs in, and what I'm seeing on the supply side, I wouldn't be surprised if oil prices moved higher. Now, I think any sharp move higher could be the last gasp, because structurally there's going to be less demand for oil over the next 20 years. But at least in the short term, I have a feeling that there's probably one last gas rally in oil prices in the next couple of years. And one last thing, I've been pretty bullish on agriculture. I think that corn and soybean prices have bottomed out here. I think that even with a trade light deal, China will be back buying U.S. ag, and that I wouldn't be surprised if soybeans went back above 10 and corn went back above 4. So without having to play that directly through those commodities, I've been pretty bullish on the fertilizer companies.
Let's come back to precious metals and talk about gold versus silver. By historical norms, we're not quite at historical extremes, but certainly the gold-silver ratio suggests that silver is undervalued relative to gold here. What's your take on the gold-silver ratio? Is silver the better play? And in general, if you were advising someone on a precious metals portfolio, between the metals, the mining stocks, how would you divide the pie in terms of if an investor has a certain amount of money they want to allocate to precious metals? How much goes into gold? How much goes into silver? How much goes into mining stocks? How much goes someplace else?
So I still tend to have more in actual gold and silver. My allocation in my client portfolios is more shifted towards that. Now, mining itself is a really crappy business, and all you had to do is follow the mining stocks over the past 20 years to realize how difficult of a business this is. Now, I do think that a lot of these companies have gotten religion in terms of not empire building and focusing on cash flows and limiting your debt and acquisitions and so on. But it's still a tough business, still relying on getting stuff out of the ground that is never easy and never seems to be done in a cost-effective manner. And if you're doing business in countries that have unstable governments, that adds a whole new wrinkle. But I'd focus more on those companies in stable geographies, stable governments that have more of a line of sight in terms of their reserve base. But again, because it's such a tough business, it's always a smaller portion of my allocation to gold and silver. I still want to have that allocation because there's certainly a lot of leverage in the model. And if I'm right that these companies have gotten religion, that if this, and I believe it is, the beginning of a short bull move higher in gold and silver, there's going to be a lot of leverage to be had in these gold and silver companies. And I do expect a lot of potential upside in that space, but it's still a smaller portion of my portfolio because, again, the difficulty in that business.
Well, Peter, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Before I let you go, please tell our listeners, first of all, for anyone who's not already familiar with it, what exactly is the book report? What does it contain? How often does it come out? Where can people find out more about it? And also, what services do you offer at Bleakley Advisory Group?
So the book report is my daily newsletter, subscription-based business that just write daily on all the global macro market and economic things going on of relevance. And it's spelled BOOCKReport.com. And it's a modest cost for an annual subscription. And Bleakley Advisory Group is a wealth management firm where I play the role of CIO. I manage two portfolios and advise on portfolio strategies for clients and all of our advisors that are here.
Well, Peter, thanks so much. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests at macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Peter. I have to agree with him on so many of the different points he brought up, as particularly his views on commodities are very much in line with my own. But what I find really interesting is how many people already believe that the US dollar top is in. There's no shortage of people on the internet and on Twitter that are really calling that, but we haven't yet actually seen even a legitimate breakdown in that US dollar. But yet it is such a strong theme amongst everyone that this is already the top's in. Isn't that weird? What's your take on the dollar there?
I don't think it's weird at all, because 85% of those same people had said that the top was in on the dollar, a point lower and a point lower than that and a point lower than that and a point lower than that. They had said the top was in on the dollar over and over again.
Yeah.
And I think the reason is that the argument that the dollar should be topping, the macro argument, is pretty darn strong if you don't understand the dollar squeeze argument, the dollar liquidity argument that Jeff Snyder has made. And I think it's no surprise that so many people were so wrong so many times over calling tops in the dollar, and it kept going higher, and they were wrong. Well, now, for the last month or so, those same people that are the same broken record saying the top is in on the dollar, and they were saying it long before it topped, they've been right for the last month. You know, a stop clock is right twice a day. Now, I'm not necessarily close-minded to the possibility that maybe the top is in, but I don't think there's any evidence that should cause us to conclude that yet. In any event, Patrick, I do want to come back to what you said about commodities, because not just Peter's interview, but also we've recently had Charlie McElligott and Keith McCullough tell us that the next big macro trend to really start thinking about is the return of inflation. Maybe it's not here quite yet, but it's coming. And when it does, it's going to change things. Traditionally, a return of inflation means it's time to start looking at commodities again. So you've put together a fantastic chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com, click on the red button that says looking for the downloads, and you'll get registered and be able to download it. Patrick, let's go ahead and dive in. On page 2 here, you've got the Bloomberg Commodity Index, which is a broad index of a basket of commodities. Why are we starting with this chart?
Well, I wanted to take a very big top-down view of the entire commodity complex. And by the way, just so our listeners know, in this chart book, I intentionally left out the precious metals. It's a market that we talk about on a regular basis all the time. And we have Jeffrey Christian coming on next week. So I think we can save precious metals and talk about that next week. But when we're looking at this commodity index, the one thing that is very pronounced is that we had a huge bear market. And the bear market in commodities seemed to have really established a low in 2016. But while the low was in 2016, we haven't seen the beginning of a new bull market. The downtrend ended, but we've now seen that commodities, more or less for almost four years now, have just been dead money. It's just been chopping sideways, and it just has not come to life. And so the question really is that if the downtrend is over and we're building a huge and extended base, very similar to what we saw gold do, I mean, are we at a point where inevitably these commodities are going to establish that key trading low and begin the next bull market, which would certainly be one of the major influences on inflation? And I think this is one of the more interesting puzzle pieces for us to keep an eye out and watch for.
Well, the old saying goes, Patrick, the longer you base, the higher in space, meaning the longer you just trade sideways after a major market ends. And as you said, that bear market ended right at the beginning of 2016. We're coming up on 4 years of basing in a sideways consolidation pattern. If the next move is up, which would make perfect sense if inflation does come back, could be a really big move up. And I think it definitely bears watching.
That's right. And so I wanted to break down and start looking at some of the individual commodities and particularly touch on even some of the ones we rarely ever mention. But I wanted to just start off with crude oil, your darling, and really just in the much bigger picture, looking back all the way to that big bear market of 2015 and 16, and then capturing what's happened since. The last year of 2019, oil has been coiling up in an incredibly tight range. And it's actually rare to see oil so range-bound as it is. And often, the next move out of this kind of a range is going to be explosive. And the question is, which direction? Obviously, everyone has a bit of a bias, but it will be really interesting to see whether oil can start punching through that kind of 60, 65 level on the upside. That could really turn the weekly chart tide to the upside. What's your thinking, though, on the bigger picture?
Well, my leaning is toward that upside breakout scenario. And the primary reason for that is I think the commitment of traders and open interest numbers are telling us that there are new buyers coming into this market. We're seeing renewed interest from hedge funds and managed money investors coming into the crude oil market. And I think that could drive us higher. But frankly, the last couple of weeks, it has just been an incredible whipsaw roller coaster ride of conflicting signals. And we've gotten some very strong technical signals that have been wrong. You know, we get a seemingly a clear indication the market closes above all of its short-term moving averages. Seems like a new uptrend is starting. The next day, we're below all of the moving averages. You think it's okay, it was a fake breakout. We're really going to break down to the downside. It trades a little bit lower, and then all of a sudden, it reverses again. It's been this whipsaw, and it looks like it's ending and it's resolving with an upside resolution as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. But the way things have been going, maybe before tomorrow is out, we'll be back down to $55 again. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, listen, this is by no means officially a breakout that you can bank on being already money in the bank, but it'll be really interesting to see whether or not the bulls can finally follow through on an uptick as we go. But I want to move on to chart four, where we have Nat Gas. And the real observation I just want to make on natural gas, obviously there's a fundamental backdrop behind it, but the natural gas has gone absolutely nowhere. I mean, it's nowhere near the upper boundary of the range like oil is. We've made it stone's throw away from the 2016 lows, and we are just beginning to see something that could resemble a bottoming formation here. It'll be interesting as we get into the winter season, which has a tendency to create some upside surprises, particularly if it's weather-driven. It'll be interesting to see whether this winter we're going to see another attempt on the upside of Nat Gas.
Well, we'll see. And remember, Nat Gas is a very seasonal commodity, very difficult to trade. That contract is known as the Widowmaker, and for good reason.
Absolutely. That pop back in 2018 was that massive short squeeze that just leveled that optionseller.com fund. And it was just an ugly, ugly scenario, but that's notorious for that. I want to move on to five, where we talk uranium. And what's really interesting to me about uranium is that uranium has had a very pronounced downtrend from actually even before 2011. I'm just showing the 2011 high in this chart. And it really has been in a very distinct bear market all the way through to the bottom of 2016. And throughout 2017, 18, and this year, it's really been basing. And obviously, we've heard many of our guests come on and tell us that uranium is actually trading below the cost to produce it in most North American mines. And so really, we have a scenario where eventually there's supply destruction developing in the uranium market. And it really does look like an extended basing formation. It'll be really curious whether 2020 will bring about a meaningful breakout in uranium.
I really don't have an opinion on the timing on this one, Patrick, but I have a very strongly bullish long-term view on uranium and on nuclear energy generally. What we're seeing all over society is people have become just completely obsessed with this idea of electric vehicles, which they think are carbon neutral when they're not. I actually saw one municipality, an article I read somewhere this week, saying a municipality was going to outlaw the use of natural gas and anything other than electricity for heating and cooking and so forth. You couldn't have any appliances in your home that were not electric because they wanted to be carbon neutral. And wait a minute, guys, where do you think the electricity comes from? It comes from coal-burning electrical plants. And if there is anything remotely close to the degree of popularity success in electric vehicles that is predicted, very soon we're not going to have the electrical grid generation capability to charge all these things. And nobody seems to think about that. So I think there almost has to be a resurgence of interest in nuclear energy and more nuclear power plants, hopefully newer, safer designs than the old ones. But I think there has to be a great future for uranium. And it seems like most of society is just deluded into thinking that electricity is an energy source. It's not. Electricity is a delivery mechanism. You've got to generate that electricity by consuming some other kind of fuel, whether it's oil or coal or uranium. So I think there has to be a future here. And for the most part, a lot of the uranium supply was coming from downblending what was previously nuclear weapons that had been decommissioned. As I understand it, most of those decommissioned nuclear weapons, that weapons-grade uranium has already been downblended. That story has played out. That supply source doesn't exist anymore. So there's going to be a big bull market in uranium. I just don't know when.
That's right. And that's a great segue to chart six when we're looking at copper, because copper is going to be in supposed large demand as the demand to build out the electrical grids grows. Obviously, in order to build the infrastructure to have electric cars and everything like that, this copper is going to be in demand. What's interesting is we had a really good bull market in copper. Well, it was a strong move nonetheless through 2016 through to 2018, where copper went from $2 to like $3.25. But since then, copper has been sort of stuck in the mud and backfilling. But unlike other commodities, which have given back almost all their gains from the 2016 run, copper has actually been holding up pretty strong relative. And it'll be really interesting to see whether these kind of levels are where copper ultimately puts in its bottom. You know, there's that old adage of, copper has the PhD on the economy. And certainly as the economy's been weak, copper has been struggling. But there's a bigger fundamental story to be bullish copper. I mean, we heard it from Peter. And it'll be really interesting to see where this starts to manifest itself. Because like uranium stocks, many copper stocks are still very much trading near the bottom end of the ranges. Like, so when you're talking Southern Copper or Freeport-McMoRan, these stocks are not far from their multi-year lows after being clobbered. And it'll be really interesting to see if and when a copper bull market will actually grab hold.
And Patrick, remember that you need copper to build the electric vehicles because you've got to build the electric motors inside them. You need copper to build out a new electric grid in order to supply them. So there's demand for copper coming from a number of different places.
All right, Eric, I want to move on to iron ore. And what I thought was really interesting about the iron ore story is that you had the very similar pattern to what we've seen in everything like uranium and so on, where 2016, we saw that low. There was that reflation impulse and that put in that short-term low. And iron ore consolidated for several years through 2017 and 18 in this very narrow sideways range, like we see on uranium or on oil recently. And then in 2019, we saw iron ore really bullishly break out. We saw it advance from $60, $70 all the way to $120 before retracing a chunk of that bull breakout. But what's particularly interesting is that many of the companies that are associated with iron ore, such as Rio Tinto, BHP Billiton, have actually been in a pretty solid bull run. And even in spite of the last couple months where iron ore has been giving a lot of this back, these stocks are actually holding up. For the fact that the majority of the commodity complex is getting hammered, this is an interesting area that has actually been already buzzing a little bit.
Keep in mind also that China is one of the biggest consumers of iron ore. So a China trade deal, assuming that one eventually happens, ought to be a boost as well. Let's move on to agriculture on page 8.
Right. And so I started with just the ETF for DB Agricultural Fund. And the reason I wanted to do this, because I didn't want to pull up all the charts on like hogs and cattle and things like this. This captures all the grains and other agricultural products in one ETF. And it really just gets the pulse on it, which is that this market has been killed, right? And farmers are in the U.S. are under a lot of pressure right now. Many are suffering bankruptcies. And this entire space has just been in an awful multi-year bear market. I wanted to focus just on page 9, particularly on wheat. And what's interesting is, again, a very similar chart pattern to what we've seen on many of the other commodities. Wheat was in a bear market from 2013 to 2016-17, a pretty consistent downtrend where we went from 950 to like almost down to 4. And as we got down to the bottom end of that range, we've more or less been in this sideways consolidation, that basing pattern that we've seen on so many commodities, and it's edged to the top end of this range. It would be really interesting to see whether wheat can get something going and break out to multi-year highs, let's say getting up to 575 or higher and really starting a new bull trend.
Well, Patrick, if we see that resurgence of inflation that Keith and Charlie McElligott have talked about, we certainly could be off and running before you know it.
That's right. And so moving on, Eric, I wanted to go to page 10 where we have the chart of lumber. And what's really fascinating was that lumber through 2016 through 2018 had a huge bull run. I mean, we went from the 220 to 240 area all the way up to 620, just a huge push. And then we had a massive mean reverting kind of, I would almost call that a crash, wiping out 50% of the price of lumber through the middle of 2018. But since then, lumber prices have been basing, and they have been basing in the sideways consolidation, again, edging to the 2019 highs, looking like it might want to go again to the upside. It'll be really interesting whether the home builders and this whole space can actually keep things going with a push here into 2020.
Well, lumber is a famously volatile commodity, and it reflects largely home builder expectations. So as we see here, through 2017, there was a lot of growing optimism that everything was fine. As the stock market started to correct, we had the VIX complex blow up in the beginning of 2018. It took a major nosedive. And the question is, when do we get to that next round of exuberance where everybody is convinced that the economy is fine and home builders are going to start building more homes? And I guess that remains to be seen. Let's move on to sugar on page 11.
Right. So the next three charts is I wanted to talk about the American breakfaster with sugar, coffee, and orange juice. And really, all three charts actually have a very similar pattern, which is that they've been in an incredibly pronounced bear market. They've just been decimated. Sugar prices have been more than halved. Coffee prices have been pummeled again over the last 5 years, 6-7 years actually. We've seen it wipe out from highs near 300 all the way down to under 100. And even orange juice futures, particularly in the last 3 years, went from 220 down to 99. And while that certainly has helped by keeping prices in the grocery stores down, these things are not only at the bottom of their ranges, but all of them have been establishing very pronounced basic patterns. And really, I think the thing that I want to capture with the entire chart book is that almost all of these commodities are creating a base, a multi-year base after being in multi-year bear market. And so if there is ever going to be this inflationary surge, and if it's going to be driven by a rise in commodity prices, technically the basing formations on all these commodities are there. And all we need is a catalyst. And what that catalyst be and when it will start, I mean, that's the secret to trading, isn't it? But it really, the foundation is there for a commodity bull market. The question is, when is it going to start?
Well, I can't tell you exactly when that's going to start, but I can tell our listeners exactly when you will be in Vancouver and then Calgary on Saturday, November 30th in Vancouver, and then Sunday, December 1st in Calgary for Options Education Day. Please tell our listeners what you'll be talking about, what is going on at those events, and how they can register.
I have the opportunity to go across Canada with the TMX Montreal Exchange to educate Canadians on options trading. And I'm going to be talking about all sorts of different option strategies, and including understanding the option Greeks and many of the terms that Charlie McElligott was referencing throughout his presentations, all the deltas and gammas. I'll be explaining it all. Those people that are geographically local to be able to make it out to Vancouver or Calgary, there are still tickets available. Make sure you click on the links and come out and see me at the show. Otherwise, just on a separate note, in Calgary on the Monday, just like I did at the Macro Voices live event, I'm going to have actually a live trading session for Big Picture Trading, where I'll be with a number of members and listeners, and I'll be firing up some live trading accounts and actually doing some real trading. So anyone who wants to learn more about that can reach out to us at Big Picture Trading as well.
Fantastic. And this episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Freelancer.com, the best place on the internet to hire freelancers for any job, big or small. Listed on the Australian Stock Exchange under ticker symbol FLN. Listeners, if you haven't already, be sure to sign up for your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our weekly Research Roundup email blast, which provides a compendium of links to all of the best free research that we could find on the internet each week, including download links for our own presentations. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we discussed in the post game. There's also a really interesting article from Kevin Muir about dealers choking on dividend risk, as well as an article written by Nouriel Roubini on why financial markets' new exuberance is irrational. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.